Talk 105.1's Art Bell. Art Bell.
Sorry that they mean so much. The sight of a touch or the scent of a sound or the strength of an oak roots deep in the ground. The wonder of flowers to be covered and then to burst up through tarmac to the sun again. Or to fly to the sun without burning a wing. To lie in a meadow and hear the grass sing. That all these things in our memories hoard and use them to help.
This is Coast to Coast AM from the Kingdom of Nine.
If you want to take a ride, hang on, because here comes Ed Dames. Ed Dames was known in the military remote viewing program that our nation sponsored with millions and millions of dollars for 20 years as affectionately as Dr. Doom. Tonight, for at least a brief period, he will take that hat off. However, some of the material that you're going to hear in the hours that are to follow is going to be disturbing. It may disturb you. It certainly would disturb children. Get them out of the room. But there is one thing about Ed, and that is things that he talks about now begin to happen years from now. As in the wild ride we're getting from our son right now. Oh, my, have you seen the stories? I've got newspaper clippings, headlines. CNN is running stories. All the networks are running stories. And, you know, they're beginning to say things like, if you were worried about Y2K, you might want to pay attention to what's going on the sun, because that may make Y2K somewhat academic. Now, I know that I've heard that one somewhere before. Ed Dames is coming up with Y2K looming ever near. That's a great commercial. All right, now, all the way from the Hawaiian Islands, an undisclosed location, actually, in the Hawaiian Islands, here is SciTech's Major Ed Dames. Ed, welcome back.
How are you, Art?
It's always good to hear your voice. It really is. It's great to hear your voice again, Ed.
Well, actually, the place I'm in is undisclosed, but I'm near a field site, a field research site. Our offices have now been completely moved from Beverly Hills, California, to the Maui Research and Technology Park on the island.
So, in other words, so that nails it down a little, Maui, huh?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, that's a beautiful island.
A very high-tech environment.
And it's a beautiful island, Ed.
It is
actually paradise. Have you taken the trip yet up toward Haleakala? And there's a windy road that goes through some of the most beautiful spots on the face of the earth, as far as I'm concerned, there on Maui. Do you know what I'm talking about?
I know the island well.
All right. Ed, we've got to do what we haven't done, I think, for a show or two, because there are so many new affiliates always, and that is, I know, somewhat painful, but we've got to tell people what remote viewing is, and then specifically sort of transition. I guess we ought to begin with the military program and move forward to technical remote viewing as you have developed it.
Let me make it as short and painless as possible then. I was the operations and training officer for a very secret military unit, a unit whose existence was only divulged to the public when I took the technology public, and then again on to the media about 2 years ago.
Nightline program.
Yes, that's correct.
Boy, what a shocker that was for everybody. One night, there's Ted Koppel actually revealing to all of America that we had this program for 20 years called remote viewing. Now, what is, everybody will say, and this is will prevent the questions, I hope, Ed. Everybody writes to me and says, God, what is remote viewing? What is it?
Well, the easiest way to explain it is the following. If you think of the entire universe consisting of information, mm-hmm. everything that exists as a pattern of information in some single-dimensional space somewhere. Think of a computer disk.
Right.
Except for this information, this library, is active. it isn't passive like a regular library or like a random access memory disk. So it's as if you are your personal unconscious mind is interfacing with a library that's talking to you. And the way that the books are stored in this collective unconscious is in the form of information patterns. Each of these patterns is unique for every person, every place, everything, and every event. What remote viewing is, the way that we began it in the military, was a way of turning our unconscious mind towards, and this is a trainable thing, we learned that we could train it, turning your unconscious mind toward these specific patterns of information that we were interested in, and in a consistent and very accurate manner, producing descriptions in terms of words and sketches about these patterns, these targets. It's come a long way since then. It's essentially the way that the unconscious mind communicates data to conscious awareness. When we train this,
would it be would it be kind of like the equivalent of opening a dictionary and finding a specific piece of information on a certain page?
It's more like an internet a search for the, or a library search for those of you who don't use the internet. You fill out your library card and you give it to the librarian, and if you're interested in, let's say, Abraham Lincoln, the librarian comes back with several books or tomes on Abraham Lincoln. If you're interested in something that's more specific, that only existed momentarily, then you might only get one book. Mm-hmm. If you conducted a library search or an internet search on something that was an abstract or general term like Y2K, you would get half the library. Because you're dealing with a very general term that is associated with other abstract ideas. A problem, for instance, that affects many different things. And so, for us, in our library search of this, what we call the matrix, a collective unconscious,
right,
this is a very unwieldy search term. But at any rate, we learn how to train people to do this. And the way that we train, the way that I train my military team, and the way that we train civilians now via our tapes, our remote viewing tapes, we train their unconscious to do all of the work by only giving conscious awareness a number. And that is all that conscious awareness has. It's just a number that is associated, well, think of it as a library card number, next in line. Your unconscious mind has to do all the work. And the real breakthrough in technical remote viewing was teaching people the protocols, the methods, and the techniques to make sure that their unconscious mind turns itself toward the right pattern of information, and that the information that is objectified in terms of words and sketches about the target is correct.
Mm-hmm.
This took a long time to develop in the military. After it was developed, I took it out of the military in about 1990 and turned it into what today is known as technical remote viewing, which is a much more evolved form. All the bugs, the errors have been worked out of the techniques.
Now, my audience should know I have a complete copy of your military record, and it is everything you say it is. It was sent to me, I don't know, a couple of years ago, 3 years ago maybe. And so I've got a full copy of your military record, and I know that what you're saying is absolutely true. People, though, still are a little bit lost when you say a number. Now, I happen to know sort of the way it works. In other words, the control person who's running or managing, I guess would be the right word, a team of remote viewers, or even one remote viewer, will assign a number to something they want tasked, finding a gas canister in Iraq, for example, or whatever. They will assign a number to that, and the number is the only thing given to the remote viewer.
That's correct.
And I have never understood, and I still don't understand, how the assignment, how that number, a random number, represents anything at all.
Let me. It is not so much that it represents anything. The reason that we need a number is a cutout. We need to keep the remote viewer blind so that their conscious awareness does not interfere their guessing or, well, this must be, or their preconceived notions about the target does not interfere with the pure stream of data associated with the target.
Okay, but
now,
here's
let me
what
back
I...
off for a moment, and I'll tell you what I mean.
Okay.
Suppose you were the tasker, and you were interested in where a missing person was located.
Okay.
All right? Let's say this was John Doe.
Right.
And you wanted a trained remote viewer to find, to look at the present location of John Doe. And
that would be you, Ed Dames. Okay.
Okay. Now let's say you're the tasker, and
yes.
you choose that target. You
yes.
want me to work the target.
That's right.
So you're going to simply, in your own mind, decide unequivocally that that's what you want to do. That's a decision that you make. Conscious awareness makes that decision.
On the part of the tasker, yes.
On the part of the tasker. On the part of the remote viewer, we have an agreement. I agree to remote view your target. Now, I do not know consciously what your target is, but my unconscious knows.
How?
Your unconscious passes to my unconscious the target.
That's telepathy, Ed.
No, it is not telepathy, Art. In that way, it is. Actually, that is telepathy. Just that part is telepathy. I agree with you there. But the rest is not, because my unconscious mind has to find your target.
Why?
That's not telepathy, because you don't know where the target is yourself.
Why, as a tasker, would it not be more of a sure thing and less troublesome for me to say, we're after John Doe, even show you a picture of John Doe and say, here is the person we're trying to locate?
Well, only a professional remote viewer can get away with doing that, because professionals are not stymied by the problem of having preconceived notions about a target. I could get away with doing that as a professional.
The
new trainee, someone who's been doing this less than a year, would have a very difficult time. For instance, what caused flight TWA-800 to explode?
Yes.
All the kinds of ideas in the press and the conspiracies and the possibilities would be swimming around a new TRV trainee's head. That would interfere with this process. So we want to keep the new remote viewer in the blind. So when someone trains to do this by themselves, they select a target. They have a target pool that they're interested in as individuals. But when they work as a new trainee, they pull one of those targets that only have a number on it, and they that they do not associate with a known target, so that the information stays pure. In fact, our accuracy rates as trainees are 80%. That is, there's a 20% error rate. But as a team, the accuracy rate on the mutually corroborating data, where two viewers say the same thing,
right.
two viewers that worked a problem and come up with the same information, that's 100%. And that's the kind of information we use in the military, the 100% information,
mm-hmm.
when matters of life or death prevailed.
In the beginning, what kind of targets was the military interested in, or is that something you still cannot speak about?
We were interested almost exclusively in strategic weapons, very high-level targets, in mostly Russia, to some degree China, and mostly our targets were what's inside that building, because at that time our technologies, our advanced technologies and exotic technologies were not good enough to see, I use that term loosely, inside of buildings, either from space or from somewhere else.
Matter of curiosity, Ed,
mm-hmm.
during the program itself, when you would give, let's say, the military hierarchy an answer to what's inside that building, would they have enough confidence in what you said to dispatch human assets who might be at risk, physically at risk, to retrieve or to blow up or whatever, what you have said is in that building? Did they have that kind of confidence in you?
never that kind of confidence in an intelligence collection. You never go, or you try to never go with a single source of intelligence. You want to combine human intelligence with signal intelligence, with photo intelligence, to look at the pattern that emerges before you act on the information.
Yeah, that makes sense.
My job was to actually orchestrate intelligence collection missions, and I would never go with a single source, not even what I came to coin the term I coined was science, psychic intelligence. So these days, as a president of SciTech, I act upon our information because we've spent so many years against certain targets and have collected so much information against them that I don't need to corroborate it with other sources of information. And indeed, sometimes, and especially in terms of enigma, scientific enigma, mm-hmm. remote viewing, technical remote viewing, is the only way to gain a handle on it, to even get the first piece of the puzzle.
What made you leave the military, Ed? Why'd you leave?
Freedom. Freedom to do what I wanted to do. And to a certain degree, I was... it was personal reasons. I was not happy with the number of lives that we were taking for the reasons that we were taking them.
Mm-hmm.
I'd rather not talk about that.
Once
an officer, as you know, once an officer starts to disagree with policy, with your nation's policy, it's time to take the uniform off.
Boy, that really makes me want to ask another question.
Shoot.
You disagreed with our nation's policy with regard, no doubt, to your mission, which had to do with remote viewing, or how you were being tasked, or...
No, it had nothing to do with remote viewing. That was just a matter of frustration. It had to do with two separate things. One was the number of lives that we took in Desert Storm, what I believe to be unnecessarily.
The American people don't know, do they?
No, they do not really know what the damage that we did.
Early in the coverage, Ed, on CNN, they just by accident happened to show some of the Apaches going down these long dug-in bunkers and just mowing people down by the thousands.
And it was worse than that.
And then they showed earth-moving equipment burying people alive. And that ran for about 30 minutes, and then all of that stuff got yanked, and you never saw it again.
It was... even Colin Powell had some problems with that. Of course, he stayed on as chairman of the Joint Chiefs. But there were many, many husbands and brothers and sons that did not go back to Tehran. And anyway, that I thought it was time to leave. I mean, you know, I like you was a young man during the Vietnam era in uniform like you.
Yep.
And lasted through that, but this one was too much. And then there was one other reason.
All right, hold that other reason until after the break here at the bottom of the hour. There were some incredibly, incredibly graphic scenes that CNN ran for a very short while at the very beginning of the Iraq War. And then all of that footage got yanked and never repeated. After that, it was press conferences and smart bombs and stuff. Again, here's Ed Dames. Hi, Ed.
Hi.
All right. You said there was one other reason other than the way we ran the Iraq War that you left. What was the other reason?
It was the straw that broke the camel's back. I was involved in reverse engineering some rather exotic weapons, very big weapons, weapons of mass destruction, they used to be called. Now, there was a particular weapon that, when tested, was so destructive to the environment, actually the atmosphere, and I won't go into details, it was so destructive that I didn't think it warranted a test, and that was one of the reasons I left, because it was far from the madding crowd. The Environmental Protection Agency, of course, was a non-problem,
mm-hmm.
but these tests were very, very destructive to the environment. The environment could not reestablish homeostasis equilibrium at all. In fact, the scientists that I was working with on these weapons were not even sure that the Earth could regenerate an atmosphere the size of which was blown away in these tests. In fact, it blew a Mount Everest-sized chunk of Earth's atmosphere out into space every time one of these was tested. So that was a little bit too much.
My mouth is wide open. Ed, did we in fact then did test this weapon?
We tested it once, at least, yes. So it seemed to me to be, although I'm very patriotic, unconscionable, because we were wounding the very planet that we were born on, and I had had enough, so I left.
Well, that certainly all makes sense. And that was what year when you left the military?
The end of 1991. I retired in December of 91.
So we've had 8 years then since that weapon you talked about, which blew parts of our atmosphere out into space.
That's correct.
I know it's touchy, and then it's hard for you to talk about a lot of that, and probably you shouldn't talk about some of it, so we'll leave it there, but boy. All right, so I think that we have a pretty good sense now of what remote viewing is. You left the military, you formed a company called SciTech, and you did work for people who, well, I don't know, were looking for people, had corporate questions. You took up what kind of assignments?
We stuck with the scientific community. Many of these were Beltway bandits, my old cronies in the military-industrial establishment that knew by word of mouth that this team existed and what we could do. And so I took advantage of that propinquity in Washington, D.C., to begin to market our company's skills and things like developing advanced propulsion systems or actually in the defense industry. And military intelligence, because that's where we had our roots, and especially scientific and technical intelligence, because that's where our expertise was really embedded. We knew what we were doing in terms of advancing engineering, looking at companies' engineering devices to see whether or not they would be a dead end, or whether or not they represented something that the company could make a lot of money in. These kinds of things.
That would make sense. I know you also have done missing children. I know, though you don't like it. I know you.
We do those as a the company currently. This is many years down the road now. We will take on humanitarian projects, and we'll take on some counterterrorism projects, but we
sure
do this openly, and we do not, we have turned down government contracts because we can't talk about the work. Later on in the program, I'll talk to you about Project Starman and its origins and how, because we had a commercial contract to look at the UFO problem in New Mexico, we could not talk a lot about the results. And that is what I wanted to avoid. So we use our very successful tape sales, the income and the profit from our company, to fund in-house studies. And I have some exciting things to talk about after I have some very Dr. Doomish things to talk about vis-a-vis
right.
that subject.
All right. We'll jump into specifics in a moment, but Mark from Canada writes, I've got the same question. Why the Hawaiian Islands, Ed, why would you consider them to be a safe place in the middle of the ocean with global warming, ocean rising, that sort of thing, tectonic movement, great big waves that can be generated from that kind of thing? Why is Hawaii considered safe? You'll make a lot of Hawaiians happy, I'm sure, with your answer.
Well, in technical remote viewing, we can look ahead to a certain degree. We can look ahead at the environment, and we can ascertain, as even advanced trainees can do this.
In time, actually. You're actually looking for
right.
time, right?
Where mind is outside of time. And very large events have a very big spike that can be seen. Think of in earlier shows, we talked about the next use of a nuclear weapon in anger, a military use. That would appear, figuratively speaking, as a big spike, a mountain that you can see off in the distance. Now, you may not know how far that next mountain is, but you can certainly see it as the next mountain or the next event, depending upon how you search this library. And along those lines, we can look at the environment, look at problems that are arising, and sanctuaries in terms of the minimum amount of environmental impact.
Okay.
These happen to be one of the places.
So people in the islands can take some comfort in the fact that you're there.
They can take some comfort if they trust remote viewing, and they can only trust remote viewing if they do it themselves and know that it works. If they do that, then they can take a great deal of solace in being here. Don't leave if you live in Hawaiian Islands.
You know, so many psychics and visionaries, when people from the islands call, it happened just the other night, and of course the people in Hawaii always ask, well, what about Hawaii? You never talk about Hawaii. And usually there's a long period of silence, and the psychic says something like, well, that's because it's not going to be there.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's not good news for Hawaii, but for a change, it's good news. You're saying Hawaii will at least fare better than average.
Much better than average, yes. We've moved our, based upon information that we were downloading from the Matrix using our tools, our problem-solving tools. Up 2 years ago, we began planning our move here, and we have just completed it. The entire company, my company.
So there's nothing left in California. You're out of there.
That's correct. Mm-hmm.
And I guess for the sake of the Californians, I should ask, hey, Ed, why did you leave California?
Well,
yes.
You know, many times we've been asked, I've been asked on your show over and over again, what about Y2K?
Uh-huh.
And my response has been, Art, it looks like the Y2K problem is eclipsed by a bigger problem. We are not picking up the idea. We in SciTech, as professional remote viewers, of something associated with massive computer breakdowns, necessarily connected with the year 2000.
Mm-hmm.
We're getting something connected with the sun, and I mean it. 2 years ago, we began to talk about this, but
that's
now
right.
I really mean it.
You know, when you first began talking about this, Ed, people scoffed. I mean, they laughed, they scoffed, many were scared. There was a whole variety of actions, but mostly they scoffed, Ed. And yesterday, Ed, I was watching CNN, and they virtually said almost exactly the same thing. You may not want to worry so much about Y2K and worry more about what's going on in the sun. They actually said that on CNN.
It's going to become grim, Art. There's going to be a series of events that are connected with this particular solar cycle that go anywhere from electrical grid knockouts to much, much more serious damage to the environment. And that is why I moved my company. Because once these kinds of things start happening, it's going to be, you know, we're facing the possibility of a Mad Max scenario in populated areas. And I chose not to be there. That simple.
Here's a headline. I can hold it up, and I will for my cameras. From ABCnews.com, it says, super flares can zap planets. Now, it says, why are we confident the sun will burn reliably for a few billion more years? Well, some suns, it seems, have hiccup, they now learn. And a Yale University astronomer, Bradley Schaefer, says, quote, I'm calling them super flares. You start looking at the underlying star, and you find they really are disturbingly similar to our sun. That is, these suns they are now observing throwing out flares that sterilize or destroy planets. Their star is just like our star, like our sun. Now, Ed, in a million years, I never would have guessed we would have... All of a sudden, we have this plethora of headlines like this. Here's another one. Shapes on sun predict solar explosions. This S-shape that they're now saying, well, it looks like when we see this S-shape, there's going to be an ejecta, meaning portions of the sun itself are blown out in one direction or another, hopefully not toward us. But, I mean, it's everywhere all of a sudden, Ed. Everywhere.
Well, they will be blown out toward us, and that's what I've been... That's what I started to... That's what Chicken Little said a couple of years ago. And that's a very difficult thing as a businessman who is trying to sell this very wonderful tool. You know, do I or do I not tell the public what we are perceiving?
Yeah.
And that those are hard decisions. I have some more to make, too. But I'm going to get out of that business really quickly because this is 1999. 3 years ago, I said on your program, and I have been saying, all bets are off in 99 because we're going to be hit so fast and so furious by so many things, particularly disease and particularly the solar effects, that there's, it's really senseless to, for SciTech to continue to predict things, with one exception, and that is we're going to look at these series of solar shots, the series of coronal mass ejections that we know are coming. We're going to look at the burn zones, where, what, and who they are impacting.
Burn zones?
Well, I'll call them that for now. You know, what the next CME, for instance, what will that affect? Will it be a series of satellites? In what orbits, at what time, or is it going to push away Earth's magnetosphere and actually the plasma come down and penetrate the atmosphere? What are the effects going to be? We're already losing our ozone layer.
How big is the spike associated with the flares?
Art, it's not just that there's a series of flares. There is one or two that we have called a kill shot. They're very big. They're so big they were foreseen more than 2,000 years ago in biblical prophecy in terms of the seventh seal events, the revelation. We talked about this before. That's what we're looking at. Really serious environmental damage with the loss of atmosphere and the loss of lives.
All right, so you've determined it's that serious. When you say loss of atmosphere, that's really serious.
I'm saying penetration of ionizing radiation right down through the stratosphere, and that is very serious, yes. So the reason that we did not pick up on these Y2K problems was because of, and this is fairly imminent now, a series of very energetic events on the sun that will preempt the Y2K problem by causing so much electrical damage to both satellites and to power grids.
And
that's why we never got the Y2K problem.
And electronic equipment generally, would electronic equipment on Earth conceivably be affected? Not just electrical grids with long lines. That's bad enough, but I mean actual electronic equipment on Earth.
I'm not sure yet, Art. I am not sure. I would be speculating. So we'll turn our attention toward that, looking at the series of impacts, the series of solar events, how much damage they will do, and where they will do the damage.
Ed, may I tell you of something that happened yesterday that I need to follow up with on my audience, with my audience anyway. Yesterday, I received a fax from a first officer of an aircraft flying, I forget, from one point toward Minneapolis. And he said, you know, Art, when we got at altitude, I have never seen a display of northern lights, the likes of the one I've seen tonight. This was last night. And he said, my skin began to prickle. I began to feel some sort of strange sensation as though we were being cooked in an oven. And I wasn't the only one. My pilot felt exactly the same thing. Today, I got a whole variety of faxes from other pilots who had been in the air, and they said, you know what? I wouldn't have said anything because somebody would have thought I was crazy, but I experienced exactly the same thing that first officer wrote to you about, major airline. What do you suppose could be going on? Now, we were having an intense geomagnetic storm at the time. We're having a lot of them. But what could they be observing, Ed? Any thoughts?
Yeah, it's just an increased solar cycle, but this one is far more it's deadly. The other solar cycles that we have had in the past in recorded history
but this one
is going to be deadly.
This was radiation. It had to be radiation because it was at night. And they were saying they felt like they were out in the middle of a Florida sunshine day getting irradiated by the sun. You know how your skin feels when you're getting irradiated.
Mm-hmm.
That's the way they felt, except it was nighttime.
And well, there's not much more that SciTech can say about this, Art. This is 1999. We've said this is the year to hunker down. And the hammer is about to fall.
All right.
3 years of warning are over. So in terms of predictive intelligence indicators of warning, Project Sunburst, which is what SciTech has called this, is coming to an end.
All right. As we may be. Well, I told you some of the material you were going to hear was going to be a little sobering, scary. And so if you didn't believe me then, believe me now. If you can't handle this kind of information or you have children in the room, then act responsibly as a parent. Get them out. And if you can't handle it, turn it off. Otherwise, my guest is Ed Dames, SciTech's Major Ed Dames, and he'll be right back. I want to get on the air. It's a faxed question from Rusty in Tampa, Florida, and it says, Art, would you please ask Major Dames if by using his tapes, a person with no skill at all can learn TRV, technical remote viewing? In other words, can hard work overcome a handicap? Can anyone learn TRV? Rusty in Tampa. Ed, what about that?
Above average intelligence. That's all that's required. That's it.
All right.
It's a powerful tool. But caveat emptor, and I've said this before, once you realize that, and it doesn't take long, a couple of days before you get this, oh, my God, this is real experience,
yep.
If you decide to continue these studies, you can never look at the world the same way again, because when you walk down the street, you walk down with a realization that there's nothing you cannot know if you apply yourself to that particular question. Let me give you a little anecdotal thing that will give you an indication of what you can do with this. And I think it's a good illustration. It isn't all doom and gloom that I do. Once in a while, I get interested in things on your show. And I caught this little anecdote by Dinah Arnett. Remember this woman from Florida, or I think Tampa or something?
Of course I remember. It was just a few days ago, actually. Dinah Arnett sent me a photograph of a hallway in her home.
Mm-hmm.
And I looked at it. My wife looked at it first and said, you better look at these. And I looked at it and I said, oh, my God, what the hell is this? A 35-millimeter photograph. You can see it on my website now, folks. And then a blow-up of that photograph. And so I called her. I brought her on the air. She told the whole story. And you have looked at that thing, whatever it is, haven't you?
Yes. She reported this as a supernatural event that occurred in her home. And, in fact, on, I think, a previous program, I have you quoted as saying, and it's funny in retrospect, you said that that thing in that photograph is nothing that you would ever want to come into even casual contact with.
That's what
you
I
called
said.
It a hideous, horrible little creature.
That's what I called it, yeah.
I have to be honest with you. When I looked at it, it kind of sent shivers down my spine because it does. It looks pretty gruesome. It is a scary photograph. But
yes.
That's what our imagination do to us and our conditioning.
She wasn't scared.
No, she wasn't. She wasn't. Very interestingly, she was not scared. I'll tell you what, it scared me, and I don't scare easily.
Wow.
But that's my imagination, Art. My imagination went to town. However, as a professional remote viewer, I had to look at this. We've worked things like supernatural events before, too, so we know when something like this is really happening. That hideous, horrible little creature that is something you would never even want to come into casual contact with,
yes,
happens to be a mosquito or a spider that hit the lens of the camera when she snapped the photo. And that story of hers is an attempt to pull the wool over your eyes. That's why remote viewing is so powerful and it's so important, because it sifts out the truth and it uncovers the truth from the chaff. That is why this technique is so important.
I've got to go back to my own website and look at it right now after what you've said.
A mosquito or a spider? I didn't take the time to continue because I realized it. And in my mind's eye, in my imagination, it would look very frightening. That's why I have stuck with this technology for so long, because it opens doors and it sees true.
You're really sure about that, huh?
Yes, absolutely sure. In fact, anyone, we have over 10,000 people that have purchased our tapes, and many of them are in advanced stages of training. I train on the internet for free, advanced skills. We help our advanced trainees find missing children, and in a present case, the body of a child that we know was killed. But we're going to, that's the kind of thing that we do in advanced training. Many of those students could have done the same thing I did had they turned their attention to this particular target. Any of them. Because it's a standardized procedure. Just like in the military, everything's standardized. We do it the same way. The techniques are rigorous and they're rigid, but they come up with the same truth each time.
You know, I'm looking at that photograph right now, Ed. And it looks to me like this horrid little thing with a squiggly tail and what looks like a horrid little mouth. It looks to me like it has depth. I mean, it would have fooled the best of any of us because it looks further into the picture. Now, it's obviously not really three-dimensional. It's only two-dimensional. And maybe it's just an optical conclusion, but it looks further away than the close wall. And boy, it really looks like it's there.
It is there. It is really on the film, but it's an insect, a small insect, either a mosquito or a spider.
Huh. All right. You have. Damn, that thing is awful.
Yeah.
You have tapes. You've had your tapes out now. Listen, folks. At one time, it used to be that to go to school, to go to Ed School or many other schools that are out there to learn remote viewing would cost you thousands of dollars. It was thousands of dollars in the beginning when you and I first talked. How much would a full course cost?
$4,500 for a 10-day course.
For a 10-day course.
We trained mostly doctors, engineers, and scientists, and then we began to take the public, and only later, 2 years later, did we put together our video training tape program.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of knockoff courses out there. There's a growing number of camp followers who have taken our tapes and have homebrewed their own courses based on that and formed bastardized versions.
I'm sure that is
of the professional take. So you got to really be careful about these.
But you were the one who blew the doors off everything. I mean, in a way, you probably pissed off a lot of people. When you put those tapes out, you probably ruined a lot of people's incomes. Didn't you?
Some. Because the tapes are far, far more professional. After all, I was the training officer for the military unit. So I was eminently qualified to produce the tapes and come up with the training program. There were members of the unit that were not trainers. They were remote viewers, and they never were in a position where they had to train other people. But they saw how successful SciTech was 10 years ago,
mm-hmm.
and they availed themselves of the opportunity to jump on board. Many of them are falling by the wayside now, but there's a lot of amateurs who have put together workshops and audio tapes. And these are fine for a joyride because they do use our techniques that we teach, but they could never teach you a problem-solving tool, and you would have to go back and relearn technical remote viewing to solve problems, even as simple as what was that in the photograph that Dinah Arnett took.
All right, look, I want to force you into making a plug here. Your tapes, before we leave this subject, are divided into modules, and I have watched, personally, module number one, which is an extremely slick, professional, well-done, well-produced, I mean really well-produced tape.
By an Oscar nominee.
I can easily imagine. I mean, it was that good. And I can tell my audience that watching module number one will tell you whether you want to proceed with the rest of the course, and whether you really want to go on and do what is depicted, what you'll see clearly you can do in module number one. Module number one is how much, Ed?
$49.95.
So for $49.95, people will learn enough to know whether they want to proceed into the really heavy-duty stuff that would be the other modules.
That's correct. And it would take, it takes 4 months to complete all the five tapes, to study them and to master them. Then people, as they're doing that, they meet me in an online classroom, for those of you who are internet capable, and I bootstrap advanced skills there, or help you out with practicums.
All right. If a person wants module number one, no sweat, $49.95. It gets more expensive if they want the entire five-tape course. You get into the real meat of the whole thing. How much is the whole ball of wax?
$249.95 for five tapes, and we include the Impossible Challenge, which is a history of our company, with that. These tapes, we dropped the price $70 on that whole set in the last 3 months.
Wow.
It was $300, $320.
Right. All right. And if they want either module one or the whole thing, there's a number they can call, right?
There's two numbers they can call.
Two numbers. All right. What are they?
1-888-878-0333.
Hold on. I write slowly, and so does everybody else. 1-888-878-0333. Or
1-877-878-1777.
Okay.
All the information they'll need is on those, and including when to talk to live operators. All those kinds of things are there.
Should people? Is it a 24-hour a day number?
Yes, these are 24-hour numbers.
So they can call now or any time. All right.
Yes.
All right. We'll get those numbers out at least another time in the show here. So Dinah had nothing but a bug. Whew. And a story. And a storyline.
An attempt to pull the wool out of your eyes. In fact, she took that photo to Whitley Schreiber. I don't think she really knew what was on that photograph. But the story was a fabrication. She took the photo to Whitley and to a number of other people who said they didn't know what that was. Well, Whitley's had a number of different experiences in his life, being visited by visitors and all of that.
Sure.
What technical remote viewing can do is to dissect those experiences and to really know whether it was a subjective experience, whether or not it was a dream mixed with something else, or whatever. And that's how powerful this tool is. I'm going to talk about Project Starman tonight. And it's worth staying up for, because it will. What we have now, in terms of Project Starman, is the end, the beginning of the end of Radio SETI, and breathing new life into the UFO problem. It's a very wonderful discovery we have in terms of Project Starman, which you know is my pet project.
People will stay awake for that for sure. All right. If I don't finish with the sun, people are going to be very angry, because people are really, really scared about this, Ed. And so let's try and give them a little bit of positive feedback. Let's say the sun is going to produce at some point a kill shot. You once told us there would be a precursor, and I was never quite clear about whether we've actually had that precursor yet or not, or whether the precursor event may not occur at all and it just may be the main event.
We know we're going to have precursors in terms of SciTech, but we were never clear in-house on what the precursors meant. What we did was we looked at a time ahead, at a number of years, circa 99 through, actually it was late 98 through 2001, and we knew there would be a very dangerous event, a catastrophic event. It took us a long time to realize it was our own sun. In fact, I call it a discontinuity 3.5 years ago on your show.
Yes.
But when we backtracked in time from that extremely catastrophic event, we saw that there would be at least one other event that would presage this what we called came to call a kill shot.
Right.
And we were never clear about what that precursor was. We just couldn't put it together. It is probably a series of smaller events before this big one. It's just, it's too close together and it's too big for us to be able to unravel, Art. But it's, I think it's problematic. If not moot, it will become moot in 99.
Are you able to discern the scale of the major event itself? In other words, killshot is kind of a negative term in the sense that when you're talking about the planet, it sounds like nothing will be left moving.
No, this will be a... This last event will be this catastrophic event.
Yes.
We're calling it killshot.
Yes.
Will actually strike land. Won't just be an atmospheric event. It appears to actually touch the ionized radiation, touch the Earth itself, the Earth's surface itself. And when that happens, you're talking about people and animals and plants being subject to high degrees of radiation, being fried in place. So that event will not be Earth-wide. We're going to try to...
It'll be somewhat localized.
Yes, that's correct.
And obviously on the sun side of the... in other words, as the Earth is facing the sun. So if you're on the night side when it hits, you're okay, more or less.
Right. Now with the new... With solar physicists really starting to take... having new tools to look at the sun, predictive tools, for instance, the sigmoids that have recently appeared in the news about allowing us an extra day to know that before an eruption
yes.
happened on the sun.
The S shapes.
Yes, it's called a sigmoid. That gives us an extra day's warning. What SciTech will attempt to do is give at least a month warning prior to the formation of a sigmoid that's connected with a very serious flare.
All right, when we come back, we'll tell people what it is that they could do if they're in that area. Stay right there. Back now to Ed Dames. Ed, that was some facts. Did you hear that?
Yes.
Is this something that... Now, this is on the night side of the Earth, albeit under a great big magnetic storm at altitude. These, you know, cargo pilots and passenger pilots get up to 33,000 feet or above a lot of times, and so they get more radiation, and there was a lot of radiation, but you wouldn't think enough to give people burns, would you?
Not at this juncture. Later on in the year, from what we know, possibly.
Right.
There's some warning here too. As long as a solar flare is not too big and doesn't destroy the satellites that we have in orbit that are looking at X-rays. And if you get a big solar flare, it's going to destroy those satellites too. But you'll have a 3 or 4 day warning because the X-rays only take, you know, 8 to 10 minutes to get to Earth and they're registered, right?
That's right, yes.
And then the protons, the mass itself that's ejected from our star, the sun, is on its way very fast, but much slower than the speed of light. Now, with this new signature that solar physicists have, the sigmoid, this S-shaped configuration
yes.
of plasma on the sun.
Yes.
Now that may give us an extra day warning. So that's 4 to 5 days of warning before we're hit by a very large shower of damaging protons, a bunch of bullets, shotgun effect.
Will anybody announce that fact to us? In other words, will somebody at the SOHO place say, hey, look at the gigantic, it's the biggest S we've ever seen, and we see it rotating our way. There is some good chance there's going to be a CME that's going to head toward Earth. Would they say that?
I used to think yes, but I don't anymore because of the responsibility that would be... What you're talking about is the ramifications of something like that would be mass panic.
Yep.
That would not be avertible. And, I mean, there are ways to protect oneself against that kind of a shower. Get into a basement, get into a subway, get into
yep.
a mine or something like that and take a lot of water with you.
That's what I was going to ask
you. There's not
next.
A lot of cavities below the earth that are immediately accessible by the numbers of people that would need to be there. And so I suspect that in order to avert the panic that...
They wouldn't say anything.
They might not say anything, yes.
Big S. Probably means exactly the same thing you hear on most flight recorders just before the pilot hits the ground. Oh, shoot.
So what we're going to do in SciTech, although we're capacity constrained and we can't do everything as professionals, we are trying to teach the public to do it for themselves, we are going to look at the series of events this year, the next one up, and attempt to determine where the damage will be incurred and to what degree. That's what we're going to try to do this year, because we know it's coming.
No way to put a more refined date on it.
Sorry, there isn't. It's the same problem that we face. Mind is outside of time. We can see this event. See, I use the term "see" figuratively, of course.
Mm-hmm.
We can perceive a large event on the horizon in our mind's eye using these very accurate techniques, but we cannot gauge the distance effectively. That's why we're still waiting for this North Korean nuke to happen. We know it's going to happen. We can perceive it. We see the next nuclear weapon being used in anger on the Korean Peninsula.
And
2 years ago, we could see that. But we can't gauge the distance and time to that mountain.
Can you tell that that mountain or that spike is prior to the event on the sun?
A year and a half ago, we thought it was. Yes. In terms of the kill shot, yes.
Yes.
Yes. The use of a nuclear weapon on the Korean Peninsula happens prior to what we are calling the kill shot.
Now, the kill shot
may be the first of a number of kill shots. And we also have an ozone loss problem, which is causing tremendous amounts of damage, especially allowing a lot of diseases to occur. I mean, we're getting a lot of mutations, and we're getting a lot of diseases that are starting to pop up. And as I've said before, these will become, a tremendously difficult problem for mankind. Disease.
And I just got a notification. I'm a ham operator, and I got a notification on another HAARP test. HAARP is in Alaska. I think most people in my audience know what HAARP is. On the 26th and the 27th of this month, they'll be testing on 3.4 megahertz and 6.99 megahertz. Have you ever taken a look at HAARP?
Well, the concept for HAARP and its actual construction occurred while I was still working at Office of Secretary of Defense level, so I'm aware of what that is, you know, what it was built for.
Well, they say it was built, Ed, and they tell the public now to test propagation conditions and to possibly map underground tunnels and bunkers. Is that what it's for?
Yes.
They're telling the truth.
Yes, I would not lie. I will say I don't know. To avoid talking about classified information, but I'm not going to lie.
Okay. So, should we need not be particularly concerned about HAARP? Or
I didn't say that.
You didn't say that.
Absolutely not. I remind you to hark back to my first 10 minutes or to after the break.
I do remember
one of the reasons I left the service.
The test.
The environmental damage that the Department of Defense cavalierly afflicted upon our own garden, and that was unconscionable.
My next question would be one you couldn't answer, huh?
Well, I'm not a psychic, so you'd have to give me 45 minutes to discern what your next question is. That's the length of a TRB session.
My next question was obviously going to be, for the sake of the audience, if there was a test, a single test of something that blew out part of the atmosphere, can you tell me whether that is connected with HAARP and we need to worry about that?
It is not connected with HAARP, no. It was connected with a Star Wars initiative, and it was a desperate, almost an act to keep up with the Joneses. I won't say who the Joneses were.
Not hard to imagine.
Mm-hmm.
All right.
one of the things that you said that we would talk about tonight is particularly intriguing. I don't have the slightest idea what it's about. You remote viewed Satan. I told you not to, but you did anyway. And it was really something else. And then you sent me a message saying for this show, we would discuss something called the Devil's Workshop. What in the world is the Devil's Workshop, Ed?
Well, you recall that I spent a lot of time looking into this concept that there is an entity that is connected with our idea of Satan.
Yep.
And we covered all of that. And
sure.
I said there's two things that I'm looking at now and I want to follow up on. One is the strategy that this supernatural entity is attempting to execute. And the other is a project that it has. Now, the strategy I talked about involved at the time our last show, I said that there are puppets, human puppets, that are being manipulated, and that this one particular stratagem involved an assassination team of three individuals that would assassinate a high-ranking Israeli cleric or official. You remember that?
Yes, I do.
And then 2 weeks after I said that, the highest-ranking officer, a general officer, General Gerstein, who was the commander of the occupied strip in Lebanon, he was assassinated by the Hezbollah. Okay. So that gives you an idea of in terms of predictive intelligence, what we're up against.
Yes, sir.
The project itself is much more serious. In fact, it is the key element in attempting to engineer Armageddon. It's a very serious thing. Very serious indeed. It's also very elegant and brilliant.
This is a project of Satan?
It is a project that it appears to be just a product of the evil that's in men's minds and hearts, but in fact there are supernatural forces behind it, and what in biblical terms has been called Armageddon was foreseen thousands of years ago. It's coming rapidly upon us in the form of this project.
Well, okay, let me see if I'm straight. I know mankind has plenty of good and plenty of evil in his own heart and mind with this free will thing, but you're saying there is a real and specific entity, the devil, Satan, who is engaging right now in a project to bring on Armageddon, yes?
Yes, that's what I'm saying.
And he will use as tools...
It. I'm not sure if they have sexes. It.
It. Thank you. Will use as tools the dark side of man. And I remember you talking about a bio warfare or chemical lab.
Yes, well, we've done much more work on this since the last program because we get to see it in all its blazing glory now, and it is a brilliant, elegant plan. But once again, it's humans being manipulated unwittingly, some key humans, because these supernatural forces are capacity constrained. They do not have that many assets, so they really have to use them wisely. And in this case, it's a brilliant, brilliant plan. As a former tactician, a military tactician, I have to say this is a very admirable, elegant plan. And it is, in fact, a good way to orchestrate Armageddon. And it's probably not stoppable, but I'm going to lay it out for you.
You are?
Yes, I am.
Well, then... let's rock. I mean, this is something we just don't skip over. It's an elegant plan to begin Armageddon. God knows there's enough bad stuff coming along anyway, but here we're going to be encouraged by an entity to end it all anyway.
Well, after I tell you about this, I do have some good news. So I will take the Dr. Doom hat off after this one, Art.
All right.
I have some very exciting news vis-a-vis Project Starman.
Starman, yes.
But I'm going to have to let this one roll because you did ask me to follow up on it, and we did.
Yes, sir.
the Devil's Workshop. I said, that's what I termed this particular facility, which was a key facility, a key element in this plan, happens to be that particular biological warfare facility that SciTech reported north of the city of Mosul in Iraq.
Mosul.
That's the facility that it is hiding in a petrochemical plant. If you go to the SciTech website, and people can go there via your site, and you go into our special projects section, you'll see a letter to the White House and to the Defense Intelligence Agency that we sent with a map pointing to the location of an Iraqi biological warfare facility. This is sort of an encore performance for SciTech. In 1991, we made world press by doing this for the United Nations and finding his Saddam Hussein's biological warfare facility. So we're back there again now, looking at a particular place. It's too late now to do anything about that place. The Iraqis have already produced more than about 12,000 liters of anthrax. And some of that is not in Iraq anymore. And that's where this all begins. But after it's used against the nation of Israel, and I'll tell you where and what the target is and how it will be used,
yes,
because that's where it's going to be used. After it's used, it is good for the Israelis to know that the source of that, in case the Iraqis claim plausible denial because anthrax is so popular these days, they can.
Mm-hmm.
The source is Iraq. Iraq produced that anthrax that will be used against the holy city, Jerusalem, the old city, in a way that is very, 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 very brilliant, brilliant plan.
Can you lay
yes.
down?
Oh yes. The anthrax. If you were to deliver a Scud missile or Katusha rocket against the Israelis, now the target that I'm saying, the target is actually, it's actually Jerusalem. It's the old city itself. If you were to deliver a missile against Israel, anywhere in Israel, it would explode, and that explosion would be ascertained as either a high explosive, or if it were a chemical or biological, it would become almost immediately known. The Israelis are the most prepared nation in the world in terms of chemical and biological warfare. If that missile explosion was deemed to be biological, the Israeli people are so well prepared that there, and I'll go into the preparations if you want, the civil defense measures, would be virtually no casualties if there was anthrax in the air.
Yeah, I saw it. I saw it on CNN. Back during the Iraq War, they were showing what was going on in Israel, and they all had places to go, masks to put on. They were, in fact, prepared.
More than that, they have actual filters in their home, in many of their homes that are sealed.
All right, hold on. We'll take a break here, Ed. We will be right back, I think, and we'll try and give you as many specifics of this. Armageddon. Gee, that is just about where they said it would all begin, or the beginning of the end would begin. We'll be right back. 1-800-377-0700. Once again, here's Major Ed Dames. Ed?
All right.
We're talking about Jerusalem. We're talking about a place in Iraq called Mosul, where they have apparently put a whole lot of anthrax together. And you said their method of targeting Jerusalem is insidious.
It's once again, this was part of this was the critical element and the core strategy in a larger plan. One of the supporting attacks was what I reported on your last show, this three-man assassination team that would assassinate a key Israeli cleric or official.
Right.
That happened, and the Israelis are still, they right now, as we speak, they're in the Gaza Strip, and they have vowed vengeance against the killing of General Gerstein.
Right.
And they're still in there attacking Hezbollah positions. So that's their counterattack. I need to just tangentially mention to you, I wanted to do a couple of cross-checks vis-a-vis biological warfare, and so I ran as a technical remote viewing cue the idea of the next bioweapon attack. Okay?
Okay.
I worked that.
Yes.
And what I got was not something like this, but to my surprise, it was the use of a biowarfare agent against the coca crop in South America. And I had forgotten all about the agreement to use a phytopathological weapon against the coca crop in South America, which is biological warfare.
Right.
Thinking that on my own mind, was the idea of what we typically think of as biological warfare, but I had forgotten that this is subsumed under that too. So that's what popped out of that, and I said, "Whoops, don't want to look at that."
Huh.
So that's the kind of things that happen in my business.
They're even going after marijuana now with a fungus. They're going to release this fungus that is supposed to destroy all the pot plants.
I know, that's biological warfare. We forget that anti-plant, anti-crop warfare is also biological warfare.
Right.
And I had forgotten that, too, when I ran this queue. So
that's interesting.
That's the kind of things that happen.
Jerusalem.
Okay. The target is the old city itself. And the way in which it's going to be hit is very interesting, very elegant. The day has not come yet where the occupied territories above the PLO lands in the West Bank, where you can tote missiles or shoulder-fired missiles up there, you're going to get caught. You might be able to get one off, but that's it.
There's people with guns everywhere.
There is. And that's why it has to be really slick. If you're going to use a biological weapon, first of all, it has to be covert. So by the time the population realizes they're infected, it's too late.
Too late, yeah.
And don't let anybody kid you. There's no prophylaxis against anthrax. A pulmonary anthrax, the type that you breathe in,
right.
There is no prophylaxis once you get it. You may be led to be to believe that by officials not wanting to scare you, saying that it's okay if you're infected, but you're going to die.
Well, they are giving anthrax shots to our military right now, Ed. As a matter of fact, it's mandatory. There are some in the military who are refusing to take them, and they're being disciplined severely.
Or discharged, yes.
Yeah, or discharged, right.
Yes. But even with a vaccine like that, if the toxicological insult, if you're hit with a lot of spores of pulmonary anthrax, that vaccine is not going to help you. And the vaccine must have booster shots over a 6 month to 1 year period before you could even hope to survive a pulmonary anthrax attack. So
that would mean spores in the air.
That's right.
Right.
That's right. And the way in which this is going to be done is very elegant. And this is how they're going to pull it off. The Hezbollah will do it. They will do it from above the old city of Jerusalem in the occupied territories. Now, this is going to derail the PLO plans because the PLO, Yasser Arafat himself has said, he wants Jerusalem to be the capital of the PLO state, once the state.
Actually, he said he's going to be declaring that shortly.
Well, I mean, it's probably a pipe dream, but nevertheless, the PLO is not going to be happy with this Hezbollah attack. Here's how it's going to come down.
Okay.
The anthrax is going to be packed, and I mean packed, in a gel. It's not going to be gelatin, because then what would gelatin do? Anthrax, of course, once it's in a bovine environment, turns on. So
right.
You don't want to turn on the spores.
Right.
So it's going to be packed in agar.
What's that?
Agar is a cellulose gel. It's used in the food industry a lot. Like gelatin, but only it's plant-derived instead of animal-derived.
Yes.
Okay? A whole lot of anthrax spores, a whole lot, packed in this agar gelatin and put in containers. It can even be bags, but it's containers. That will be carried in surreptitiously to the hills above the old city of Jerusalem.
Yes.
It will be placed in shallow holes that are scooped out of the dirt or in the rock itself. The top will be taken off of the container, or could even be a sack, and it will be exposed to the sun. When it dries, because what makes gelatin gel? Water.
Correct.
And when the sun evaporates, the water in the gel, it slowly, day by day, it leaves a powdery film on the surface of almost pure anthrax spores, which are now, under the force of gravity and the wind, they become a plume that drifts down from above the hills in Jerusalem into the old city, slowly infecting and continuously, I might add, infecting the population of Israel. And the Israelis will not know what hit them because the attackers will be long gone. The city will continue to be infected as long as this gel evaporates, and many, many people will die as a result of this.
Good God.
So it's imperative to the Israelis, and I have contacts in the Israeli Defense Force, to watch for these kinds of things, to fly a helicopter above the hills, above the old city, look down from the helicopter with binoculars for anything that looks like a container that's open, because that is exactly what these things are going to be. The Iraqis will have plausible denial. After all, anthrax, designer anthrax is everybody's weapon these days, so the Iraqis could say it wasn't us. For all intents and purposes, it could be some guy from Colorado.
Well,
it's everybody. It's a possible thing now.
It's true. If the Israelis are aware of who has attacked them, Ed, they have said, and I would expect that they would bring up from the desert floor some nuclear devices and hence would begin Armageddon.
This becomes very interesting because the counterattack, look at the attack site. It's Jerusalem itself.
Right.
It's one of the most holiest shrines in the Christian, both Christian and Hebrew world.
I was there.
But it also contains the Dome of the Rock.
Mm-hmm.
Probably the third most important holy site in the Islamic world.
Mm-hmm.
So, one of the things that the Israelis would certainly do if they did not respond in kind. First of all, you know, they're not going to take SciTech's word that this was the Iraqis. The Israelis are not going to be sure.
Mm-hmm.
But they are going to have to retaliate in some way. One of the ways they would do it would be to cordon off the entire old city. That means preventing Muslim people from traveling to the Dome of the Rock.
Yes.
That is almost as bad as intervening the Hajj or attacking mm-hmm. Medina or Mecca.
Yeah, that's
in
right.
many ways. And
that's
so,
right.
no matter how you cut it, it's a bad situation, but it's a brilliant plan if you're the devil. Because the indirect response mm-hmm. is just as bad as the direct response. The direct attack, the direct counterattack, and the indirect counterattack, it's the same. Cordoning off the old city, including the Dome of the Rock. And then, of course, what this means is that any hope for the PLO to establish a state that close within what is now Katusha range, it's gone. Any hope of a PLO state is gone. So it derails that process permanently. It's a brilliant plan, you have to admit.
I do.
It gives new meaning to the term Satan bug.
Satan bug. Boy. All right. Somebody here asks, I'm going to drag you away from this now because I know you have other things you want to talk about.
Good.
Art, I've been listening to you for a year now, and I've heard many predictions of Earth changes around the millennium. I have a family in the Caribbean. Ed's in Hawaii. But I want to know, how's it going to be in the Caribbean? This is somebody from New York City.
I don't know, Art. I just don't know. There's what I did was look at one particular. There's two reasons why I'm in Maui. Two reasons. One is because I know it's a safe zone. One of the reasons is that the population density is low. The resources, I can live off the resources here if everything goes down, right?
Absolutely.
There's plenty of fish.
Plenty of fish,
and mangoes.
Oh, yeah.
There's not that many people. That's a fact of life.
Yep.
Okay. Secondly is Project Starman.
And, of course, it's isolated from large cities that might overrun something on the mainland.
That's right. Now, when I say the Hawaiian Islands are safe, I don't mean to say the Honolulu is safe.
Oh.
Oahu is a very densely populated island, so they might as well be a suburb of L.A. in terms of Mad Max scenario. Population density is an important factor, if you know what I mean. That is why isolated communities are very survivable, even though it may appear that they don't have the kinds of resources that I have here. For instance, one night, I, as a diver, could feed an entire village with food in a night dive,
mm-hmm.
with a light and a spear.
Sure.
So it's easy to eat here, for instance. But there's another reason why we're here, and that's Project Starman. Where these other areas are that we used to call sanctuaries, we have tried to teach our students to use technical remote viewing
to figure
discern
it out for themselves.
For themselves. Based upon their own personalities and desires.
All right, we'll hit Starman at the bottom of the hour. There's one thing I really want to ask you about. This is a dangerous question, and you may not have an answer or want to answer it, or you may want to look into it. I've had a whole bunch of people lately looking into NEXRAD radar anomalies. Now, this NEXRAD radar appears to be showing some... It's showing a really, when it looks at precipitation like snow or rain or something like that, it appears to be illuminating energy bursts that are quite specific, Ed. I don't know if you've had a chance to look into them or not. Some people think it might relate in some way to weather control. Other people think that it's just some kind of scalar weapon technology being tested or used for whatever purpose, but this NEXRAD radar appears to be illuminating the use of whatever this is. And we don't know a whole lot more about it than that, except that it's scaring the hell out of a lot of people. One really well-respected scientist, if he were to comment on it, has squarely told myself and Richard Hoagland that he would be killed. He'd be dead. Is this something that you have either knowledge of, looked into, or will look into?
Well, we'd be willing to look at anything, but what is the geographical location of these energy sources, these energy bursts? Has that been ascertained?
In many, many locations, from North Carolina to southern Texas to simply locations where NEXRAD has looked at an area of precipitation, and instead of the usual precipitation pattern that's seen, you can see what seems to be a ring of energy impacting, and literally kind of like a rock in a pond with a wave shattering out from it. And this is simply getting painted by the radar in the precipitation, if you follow me.
Yes, to a certain degree. Is the ring, does it propagate, does the wave propagate laterally?
Outward from a center point, like a circle.
Oh, so it propagates spherically?
Yes, sir.
In terms of radiance?
Yes, sir.
Downward as well as upward?
It's hard for me to judge. I'm not the expert in this, Ed.
Well, this is the way we would target that, Art, and we can, if you'd like. You know that we like to do these kinds of things to break up the monotony, especially since we're getting out of the doom and gloom business, because
right.
We are, and I mean that. You know, the jig's up, and let's go on to other things here. But these are fun things for us to do, and I'll tell you what we need, what I need in terms of targeting material. I need a specific event, either a radar photograph.
Oh, I can do great things for you. If you go to Richard Hoagland's site, theenterprisemission.com,
uh-huh.
there are many, many photographs of this NEXRAD radar.
Okay, well, that makes life really easy for us, because now we know, instead of talking about something, we have a photograph, number one, we can determine whether a photograph is contrived or not, and if it's not, we can go to the source of the target, which is whatever produced that particular array or pattern.
Oh, these are definitely not contrived. These are real photographs. Nobody argues that. They're on, you know, official sites.
Well, you know that in my business, we don't assume anything.
True.
So I'm not, of course, I would not denigrate anybody's, I'm not questioning that they're not veridical. I'm just saying that I can't afford to do that in my business. So I assume that you're correct, but we have to double-check, too, to see if the photographs are contrived. Because we've been throwing all kinds of tests, both as a military team and as remote viewers over the years. You know what I mean.
Well, I would like you to take a look at this if you'd be willing to.
We certainly would, and we'll do that. So I'll take a look at that for you.
And I think the other thing that I would like you to look at, if you wouldn't mind, is these now many, many reports I have from pilots of what appear to be radiation burns. Now, X-rays, I can see at altitude during a solar storm, you might be bombarded with X-rays, but nothing that would burn your skin, and
That sounds like high-power microwaves.
Yeah, it really does.
That kind of burn through a fuselage could be produced by high-power microwaves.
All right.
I mean, now, to a certain degree, a fuselage, of course, would turn that into electrical energy once you hit metal with a microwave.
Right.
You know, you get an electric current, but still some of it penetrates the cabin. That sounds, in that case, like HPM.
All right. I'd appreciate it if you'd look into that one. There may be some prizes, surprises awaiting you there. All right, listen, we're going to pause, and when we come back, we're going to talk about Project Starman. So don't go away. I'm Art Bell, and this is Coast to Coast AM. SciTech's Major Ed Dames, who is going to tell us about Project Starman. This is something we've been sort of hearing about for, I think, about a year and a half, Ed. I think a year and a half ago was when you first mentioned Project Starman, and early into the whole thing you said, you can't talk about it yet. And then you opened up a little bit on Starman, and I recall you saying that it was a project for contact.
Correct.
Where do we go from there?
Well, I've gone quite a ways from there. This was my own personal project. It has been for quite a while. The company's responsibility is to train the public in remote viewing. But this, Project Starman, is my own personal project. And it has its roots about, 15 years ago, actually 10 years ago now, when I led a team of very prominent scientists into the deserts of New Mexico to study the UFO phenomenon. And that is really where Starman had its start. We failed as a team. We only got spurious. The reason that we went to a certain area in northern New Mexico was because of continued sightings of anomalous things in the sky, UFOs. But they were very, very frequent. So I led a team of very prominent scientists. In the future, I'll introduce you to one. And we went there armed with the best equipment and the best detection and measurement devices that you could possibly imagine. And we failed. We failed to be able to really get a handle on what we were measuring. But those days are gone. And SciTech has continued that particular project to attempt to discern, not only discern what we are dealing with, but to contact it. And that's what Project Starman is all about. I want to just diverge for a moment and talk about one other thing that was a spinoff of my company's research in the Starman, if I may.
Sure.
Because it is also revolutionary. Do you remember, I guess about 2 or 3 years ago, and it seemed like a passing fad or a passing a phenomenon of interest in the UFO community and in cryptozoology. And that was the rods. You remember the rods?
Of course, Jose Escamilla.
Jose Escamilla and others. And it took a whole lot of courage to stand up there with a straight face with these photographs and say, this is a new form of biological life form on Earth.
I agree with you. And I've had him on at least 3 times.
Oh, yeah. I didn't know that.
Oh, yes.
I wondered if you did a program on this or not.
Yes, oh, yes, 3 of them.
Well, I saw a picture on the internet of these things, and I thought, man, you know, if you're going to pull a hoax, at least do a sophisticated job. This is really hokey. And that's what I thought. But I looked at these things, I said, wow, wouldn't it be something if a whole new life form had just passed us by and it looked like this?
Right.
And I thought, nah.
Uh-huh.
And I never looked at it. Well, serendipitously, these things popped in at our research site in the field.
What?
And it turns out that they really do exist, and they really are life forms that have completely passed biology by. In fact, they represent a whole new branch, a whole new kingdom in the tree of life. Plants, animals, indeed, and I've called them, I coined the name Aeolium.
Aeolium?
Aeolium, from the Greek god's name Aeolus, who was the Greek god of winds. These things are real, and they really are living things. Where they came from, whether or not they've always been here, I do not know. What part they play in the ecology of the planet, I don't know that either. They appear to have different species. They appear not to be more intelligent than either an insect or somewhere between an insect and a bird, but they are real, Art.
I think they're real, too, and he's able to document what appears to be intelligent movement. Now, we don't really see these things, but at certain camera speeds and shutter speeds, you see them.
Well,
you can record them.
Capture.
You can actually record them.
Well, what we've at SciTech, we just, again, this was purely by accident, purely serendipitous. It was an adjunct to our Starman studies. We now know how to attract them like moths to a flame, and that's nice because we can spend more time studying them, which is not my primary purpose. I mean, I did not want to do this, but I think it's pretty important in terms of biology. And
how do you attract them?
That's a trade secret right now.
Ha-ha.
But I just, you know, your great-great-grandfather's great-great-grandfather thought the world was flat. And there's a lot of things happening. That was only, what, 8 generations ago?
Uh-huh.
And a lot of things are going on here now that would have been as inconceivable as electricity to that generation. And this is one of them, I think. This whole new life form has passed us by because our eyes cannot see that particular spectrum very clearly, nor can we process information that rapidly. We're bandwidth limited. So we need instruments, Art, like the microscope, like the telescope, and like other things. Instruments become really important because if we don't design them correctly, we may miss entire life forms. The idea that Ray Bradbury had when he wrote the book Martian Chronicles about building an entire city on top of people who you can't see and having them try to communicate with you, that may be very real. So when we go out to the stars, if we ever make it that far, we need to take instruments that are designed and engineered to look for possibly life forms like this that we'll now begin to study.
Well, Jose Escamilla will get a great boost from what you have said.
Well,
he's a remarkable guy. It's really gutsy, as you point out.
Lot of guts to do something like that because, you know, I'm sure that I was not the only one that had a reaction like this. And yet, I thought, wow, wouldn't it be neat? And it is.
It is.
Real.
All right, back to Starman.
Okay.
Now.
All right.
We really want to get it in this remaining 15 minutes of this hour, if we can.
Okay, let's go. SETI, in terms of radio SETI,
right,
turns out it has it backwards. We need to establish contact first and then communications. And that, to make a long story short, we've hit pay dirt in Project Starman. All of these things, these anomalous things that we call UFOs that we can't understand, that flit around, it turns out are projections by many different cultures in a federation who do not explore other worlds, at least one window of evolution from, let's say, 1,000 years ahead of us or 100 years ahead of us to 100,000 years ahead of us. Those worlds use a set technology that's standardized to explore the universe. And it's not spaceships traveling from one star to another, light years away.
Mm-hmm.
It's a technology which is fascinating. They can project a tool, an opening, a time-space opening to a world that is distant. And one time on your show, I mentioned that I told you that the Billy Meyer UFO cases were entirely fabricated, but that the Carlos Diaz so-called plasma ship was a real thing. Are you familiar with this?
Yes.
In Mexico.
Oh, yes.
It turns out it looks like this plasma ball that is flitting back and forth in this man's backyard. That happens to be a tool that is essentially a window, an opening through time-space by another race in a distant world. That particular one is a culture of creatures that look like upright newts.
upright newts?
On a gas giant planet, a planet that we could not survive at. And yet the technology that they use to project this particular tool, this window to explore other worlds, is the same as other worlds exploring their world. It's standardized. It's a technology that's very advanced. They can use it to peer into our world, to look around like you would, let's say, a laser introscopy where you stick a device in a car engine or inside a human being and look around for a tumor.
Yes.
They can poke that through time space to a world of their choosing. And this is standard technology. They can see us, Art, but we can't discern them very readily. And that's the trick, and that is what we found at Project Starman. SciTech had identified a place that other civilizations were very attracted to here in the Hawaiian Islands, very attracted to. And we knew that by, in fact, we used a lot of the profits from tape sales to buy equipment to set up after having done the remote viewing to learn how to attract the attention of these other races. We did attract their attention, but we can't see them like they see us. And that is the discovery. We need to illuminate them with the proper energy. We need to shine a flashlight of a certain spectra on them. And when we do, we can see them also. And when we do that, that's when communication can begin. So, for instance, at a certain location in the field that we know they come to, it's about 10 kilometers away from where we had originally set up now, they're there, and we have to illuminate them. And what we plan to do is to do things like take a diorama of the local universe, let's say our solar system,
mm-hmm.
and the neighboring bright stars, and allow them to point out where they are from, which direction, which system, those kinds of things. Of course, if they have the technology to do what they're doing, they probably will come up with a better way to communicate. But this is a first step, and it's a very important one. Because this is a reflection, it's a projection, and we need to provide the screen. And these kinds of screens, a little platform, essentially. In fact, the way it looks in the field, and we will have scientists here in about 6 months.
Yes, sir.
The way it looks is the Star Trek TV series where you have this teleportation room.
Right.
It's a platform like that that is illuminated by a certain multiplexed frequency of energy. And when these things pop into that, then you can see a form. And the form, they can manipulate galactic distances away, many parsecs in some cases. They can manipulate this and move from one place to another within this platform. And that's how communications can be started.
Mm-hmm.
Now, we're going to have to call some, I am not a physicist, I am not a mathematician, and I'm not a cryptologist. We'll have to call some brainy people in to be able to establish that, because we're dealing with very brainy races. And this is where my level of expertise drops off. I'll have to back away to allow the real scientists to establish communications with something that it will always be there. But these other races will inform the others in the Federation that we have finally mastered a way to see them. We've finally figured it out. So we should get a lot of visitors. That they may even come someday when we have this technology and do the same thing. But that's probably beyond my watch. But that's what we're dealing with here. So in about 6 months, one of the team members, one of these prominent scientists that I had in the field 10 years ago, I will invite back along with other astrophysicists, possibly even members of the U.S. Air Force.
Mm-hmm.
And so we don't blindside the Department of Defense on this, and we'll make this public.
Wow.
That's what we're dealing with.
No small matter.
Not at all. Not at all. And where we go from here is anybody's guess. So when all these terrible, it's ironic that at a time when the environment is crashing, when diseases are spreading, and all of these biblical, prophetic, terrible events are happening, we have this wonderful thing happening again. 3 or 4 years ago, in fact, it was longer than that, my company predicted that we would have contact of some type, but it would come at a time when Earth is going through these terrible throes. I don't know why that is.
Okay, I don't want to overtask you, but there is one other really wild thing that's going on right now that I would love to have you take a look at.
Okay.
I don't know if you've caught any of the shows, Ed, but there's something going on with contrails, jet contrails.
I've heard some things about it. I don't think we're going to have time to look at it, but I will give you my hunch about what that is based upon my military experience.
All right.
Okay?
Sure.
These contrails are patterned. They're crisscrossed and they're X'd and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
I heard that they make people, later on, people are becoming sick over populated areas.
That's right.
I don't know if that's true or psychosomatic or what. Maybe. But I do know from my experience what that might be. You're familiar with LIDARs and how LIDARs are used to sense, for instance, in weather detection, every city has a LIDAR, right?
Actually, I'm not. What is it?
Okay, LIDAR is light detection and ranging. Instead of using radar, light is used. A laser beam that's shined out on toward the horizon or up in the air. For instance, in weather use, it's a form of remote sensing.
Gotcha.
My business is remote viewing. This is remote sensing. It measures the water vapor content in the air and other things, too. We used it in the Department of Defense to look for poisonous gases in the air, nerve agents, things like that,
right.
or to microorganisms or viruses or things that don't belong in the air, large quantities that may tip us off to a biological attack.
Mm-hmm.
Okay?
Mm-hmm.
But in order to use something like that, a LIDAR, you have to calibrate it. So, for instance, if you had a battlefield laser,
yes,
a good thing to do would be to put a mirror on the moon, and that way you could calibrate your laser every night. I won't say any more about that. But in the case of a LIDAR that's used to detect whether or not there's something in an aerosol,
yes,
that you may not like having to have on your terrain,
yes,
you need to calibrate it. So you need to put something in the air that's a known of so many angstroms long, so many angstroms wide, and you need to put a whole lot of it in the air at a certain altitude.
So you're saying it might be a test?
What I'm suggesting to you is that it's a calibration test for LIDARs on the ground and LIDARs in space that are looking down on Earth so that we can have satellite detection of a strategic biological or chemical attack on one of our coastlines. That's what I'm suggesting to you, and that's what I'm saying this probably is, especially when it's patterned and especially when it occurs at set altitudes.
But, again, so that everybody's sure, that's a guess at this point. That's not a remote viewing result.
No, I don't think... I think it's going to take us probably... Oh, I'd say 5 days of work just to figure out what is causing the patterns in the next rad on the next rad radar screen.
That one I really want to know about.
Yeah, and that's 5 days of work, and we're really busy on other things too. So it's going to be a while before we could get around.
That's all right.
And also I teach art every day on the internet.
On the internet, and that's for the people who have the tapes. As we end this hour, let me give out the number for the tapes. And what I recommend to everybody out there is, listen to me closely now. Get module number 1, and that will tell you whether you really want to get into this. It's $49.95, and you can get it by calling one of two numbers. 1-888-878-0333. That's 1-888-878-0333. Or 1-877-878-1777. That's 1-877-878-1777. $49.95, and trust me, after viewing that, you'll know whether you want to move on or not. If you want the whole ball of wax, it's $249.95, and you will become a remote viewer if you want to. Be sure you know what you want. I'm Art Bell, and this, just before we go to the phones, and I do need to go to the phones, Ed, to let people ask you questions. We've opened up a lot of material here. This is a kind of an intelligent question by facts. Hey, Art, could it be that Mars was the victim of a massive solar flare, the result, the evaporation of water and the dispersion of its atmosphere? Now, that's exactly what occurred to Mars. A lot of scientists think that it was hit by an asteroid or something of that sort, which grazed the atmosphere. But, you know,
this person has a pretty good point. When you consider the atmosphere evaporated, the water dispersed, what do you think, Ed? Is that possible?
I think it's possible. In fact, when you remote view the planet's past, it does appear as if it was a very large body, a comet or a large meteor. It looks like a comet actually grazed the planet and set into motion this a cyclic wave that started. It left a hole in the atmosphere, grabbed some atmosphere, the gravitational pull of this mm-hmm. perhaps comet, leaving a hole, and it started this motion where the atmosphere split and began, the pressure waves began to travel around the planet and then come back in a wave type of a motion. And each time that it came back upon itself, it pushed more of the atmosphere out into space. That's what it appears to us as lay people. We're professional remote viewers, but in terms of understanding science, we're still lay people.
Mm-hmm.
And it looks like something like that happened. In fact, you know, we don't have the whole story. We've never really studied it because of the utility of value of it wasn't there.
And nevertheless,
and I had a question. You gave us a little bit of insight on UFO sightings being a window for other civilizations to look in on us. Have you ever remote viewed the situation of abductees and abductions and such?
Yes,
many times over many years. Most of those abductions, most of the reported abductions, are not what we are talking about tonight in terms of Project Starman.
Okay.
They appear to be more esoteric in nature. For instance, most abductees that we remote view, they report being physically somewhere else or in a machine, and yet when they are remote viewed by a team of professionals, we find that during the time that they reported the event, they're lying down in bed in a catatonic state and or asleep, but their minds are on this magical mystery tour. So there's actually something going on. Something is manipulating their mind, their brain, but not their bodies. And that is a typical abduction experience in terms of what, of our expertise.
Mm. Okay, so you think possibly that entities are forcing, say, an out-of-body experience?
Something like that. All I know is that I don't understand it. As opposed to this other Starman site where we're about to have an exchange, an intelligent exchange via these windows, this other type of event that we have has been come to be in the literature to be known as an abduction, we don't understand it. It appears to be almost metaphysical.
I see. So, and these windows are strictly for looking, but not necessarily stepping through or coming here.
No, they are strictly for looking. They're just windows. This technology that appears to be in use by many civilizations does not lend itself toward rematerialization somewhere. I don't discount that, but maybe instead of being 1,000 years ahead, you have to be 100,000 years ahead to be able to do that. I don't know. I'm very happy with what we found, but it is a communications exchange medium and a remote sensing medium and not a rematerialization portal.
I see.
Teleportation portal.
Mm-hmm. Do you think we'll learn that ability to look into other realities?
I've discussed this with my vice president in the last couple of days, and that's certainly a goal. I don't know if it'll happen on our watch, but I mean the easiest way to do that would be once we're able to communicate, to exchange information with some of these races, to be able to learn how to use the standardized procedure. And it does involve a technology, by the way. It isn't strictly a mind type of out-of-body experience. There's a technology involved. It is very advanced. Maybe they can give it to us. I mean, what harm would that be?
It wouldn't be any harm at all. It'd answer a lot of questions.
All right.
Thank you.
Thank you. Wild Card Line, you're on the air with Art Bell and Ed Dames. Hi.
Hi, good morning. Ed, within the last week, there's been maybe five or six stories that have broken in on the wires concerning intelligence matters. The Chinese, obviously, Los Alamos. When you look at it, and I don't want to obviously press you for any classified information, obviously, at all, but when you look at it as a civilian right now, and you look at the world situation, how it is, do you believe that the Russians and the Chinese are preparing for something other than amiable ends? And do you think that the disinformation that we're getting, is it necessarily coming from a right-wing side, or is this really good information? And I used to raise my eyebrows when you talked about the next nuclear event coming in Korea, but then the Washington Weekly broke a story that the North Koreans said in their talks, their supposed inspection talks with the United States, saying, you will never see our nuclear weapons. And when I saw that, and then I related it back to what you said, my eyebrow didn't raise anymore. It went down.
I know. I've been hearing a lot of stories about Korea.
So basically, Ed, how do you see this world situation? Is Russia and China basically and North Korea preparing for war?
The North Koreans are erecting missiles as we speak.
Mm-hmm.
And the South Koreans are using verbiage like this. They're considering a preemptive strike.
Mm-hmm.
So, it doesn't take doesn't take much to imagine what's next. My take?
Yes.
The Chinese are the winners. Any way you cut it, the Chinese are they're going to win. The Chinese will be on top. I don't know how long they'll be on top.
Right.
I don't know how long it will take them to be on top, but they stand to win. They're the winners in this this game. Think about it.
Can I go out? Just for real quick, the second part of my question was, when we see this nuclear event and this sun event, which now I'm beginning to be a very true believer in what you're saying, do you see, once again, a figure, let me just put it this way, a human antichrist, whatever, however you want to call it, a figure coming on for a short duration of time in here and sort of making everything okay, but really he's a deceiving type of being?
That's really quite a good question, Ed.
Yes, yes, I agree with Revelation per that description. I think that, think about this. That particular story, Revelation, would not have lasted this long if it didn't contain a lot of truth. It would have been adulterated and many versions passed down. It wouldn't have withstood the test of time. I think it's generally correct, this idea about, and we've remote viewed this and reported on earlier shows about the opening of the sixth and seventh seals, sixth seal being characterized by increased volcanism. I said that would start in about a month. Well, it's happening. So hold on to your hats now. That at the story, as reported by the biblical prophets and in Revelation, it appears to be generally correct. And there's no reason to discount that the rest of the story isn't accurate either.
I'm curious, Ed, when you tell us things are going to happen, and then a year or two later they begin happening, how does that settle in on you? When you pick up a newspaper and you read headlines about frogs dying, or you pick up a newspaper and you see scientists talking about the sun doing the things you're talking about it doing, does that affect you in some strange way, or do you just sort of go, yep?
I've changed the way it's affected me over the years, but I still feel, even though I think that we've stuck our necks out in a lot of ways. I mean,
Oh, I know.
But I still feel sad. I feel happy for myself, but I feel very guilty. The same way that on a personal level, the same way I did when all my friends were killed in Vietnam, I felt guilty because I was still alive. That's similar to the feeling that I have now that really hits hard, that, hey, I have this wonderful tool, I'm a professional, I can see what's coming down, I can get out of the way, but all of these other people don't have these expertise. And some of these people are the ones that kept me alive. The doctors that repaired my bones when they were broken. The dentist who fixed my teeth. The guy who fixed my car so I could get to work. All those poor guys are out there, and they're not where I am. And so that's what I mean about that feeling. That's the way it makes me feel, all right?
All right.
And there, nothing you can do about that.
East of the Rockies, you're on the air with Major Ed Dames and Art Bell. Hi.
Good morning, gentlemen.
Good morning. Where are you?
I'm in Fort Myers, Florida.
Okay.
This is John.
Hi, John.
Ed, are you aware of this object that is supposed to be in close proximity orbit around the sun?
I've heard the report.
Oh, yes.
And that's all.
Could you do us all a magnificent favor and do a remote view of it and find out what it is? Because I believe that it might be...
I need a photo and or a radar image or something, that otherwise it becomes what we call, in my business, a topical search.
All right. Well, there was, Ed, a photograph taken by SoHo of this object just before they shut SoHo down. Correct, caller?
Yes, I also believe that it is a remote possibility that it might be Zachariah Ascension's Nibiru.
Well, Nibiru would be an awful lot bigger, I think, but I don't know what the size of the object is.
I would be interested in looking at it, actually, but it would be very helpful to me. It would save a lot of time if I had something if I had imagery.
Let me see what I can do. I'm looking for that one myself. I know that photograph is out there. West of the Rockies, you're on the air with Major Ed Dames. Hi.
Major Dames, Mr. Bell, good morning.
Good morning.
This is Patrick from San Diego. Pardon me. I got several points I'd like to get to, and I hope I'll have a chance. And I am a gentleman, at least I like to think I am, and but I do want to take your guests to task, since no one ever does seem to do that.
Go for it.
Are you up to the challenge, Major Dames?
I
would imagine, being a former military man, you're not too thin-skinned.
All right, go ahead. Just go for it.
All right. First of all, in your board of directors, is John B. Alexander one of the members?
Not any longer, but he's still a confidant and an advisor.
I like John Alexander. John Alexander is my friend, so
be
careful.
For the listener's benefit, he's non-lethal weaponry is his baby.
That's right. That's correct.
You said one of the reasons you undertook remote viewing of Satan was because of children killing children. I suggest the possibility that rather than being possessed or under the influence of Satan, these are instead Manchurian high schoolers or Manchurian junior high schoolers. The primary, that may sound far-fetched, but I don't think more far-fetched than the idea of robots swarming under the monuments at Mars, tending to...
Well, no, wait a minute. Slow up for a second. What does all this have to do with John Alexander?
Well, the primary allegation in Alex Constantine's book, Virtual Government, is that Major Dames and SciTech are essentially a front for illegal mind control experimentation, non-lethal weaponry, and electronic harassment.
Oh, Ed, have you been doing
subjects.
That? Have you been doing that, Ed?
Sir?
See, I don't think so.
I have a few other things I'd like to mention.
All right, go.
Regardless of a debate between Major Dames and Alex Constantine, I would certainly at least like to see some of these guests on the show to present a different side of things. Alex Constantine or Walter Boert, author of Operation Mind Control, Jim Keith, John Judge, or how about
Barbara Honegger, send me some phone numbers.
I presented a list of researchers to you in person in October of 1997.
Yeah, but I need contact numbers.
I gave you contact information with those names as well.
Not that I saw.
Well, they were on the list. As another person that would be great as far as remote viewing goes is Barbara Honegger, who resigned from the Reagan Justice Department in 1983. But more to the point of our discussion, she is one of the first people to graduate with a degree, an accredited degree in parapsychology from John F. Kennedy University in Orinda, California.
Recommending other guests now,
and,
but that's fine.
She worked at Stanford Research Institute with Russell Targ and Harold Puthoff, and I think she would have a very different take on remote viewing than, say, Major Dames or other guests.
Love to talk to her. Get me some numbers.
Well, as I said, I did present these people to you
before. Yeah, but you didn't present me with numbers.
I gave you contact information. Alex Constantine, you can get a hold of him through Barrel House Publishing in Venice, California.
All right.
His book publisher.
All right. Anything else?
That's about it.
All right. Thank you. It's not as easy as you may think. People say, get hold of this person. Get him on the air. Well, I jump through hoops and I call publishers, and it's not always so easy. You can spend an hour on a phone getting transferred all over the place trying to find somebody who published some book through some publisher, a contact number, the agent that handles them. It's not so easy. I'll have anybody on the air, damn it. You ought to know that by now. Anybody. But I do need, when you suggest a long list of people like that, you did not give me numbers, sir. And it's very difficult. First time caller line, you're on the air, Major Ed Dames and Art Bell.
Hello?
Hello.
Yeah.
Call the wild card lines, area 702-727-1295. I'm going to have to bleep that out. We don't allow last names on the air. So
I'm sorry.
Let's try it again. You're calling from Ottawa, Canada, and your first name is?
Tony.
Tony. Yeah. All right, Tony.
I've been listening to your show for several months on and off now.
Yes.
And I've particularly followed, I guess, your concern about this period, which is called the quickening.
Yes, sir.
And I've listened to...
It's not exactly a period. It's a process, but go ahead.
Right, right. And I've listened to Major Dame's different discussions about, I guess, what would be referred to as a period biblically, which is referred to as tribulation.
Yes.
And I've wondered if Mr. Dames has ever considered the possibility that if the Earth went through a very difficult period in terms of its atmosphere and atmospheric problems or disturbances and effect on plant or animal life, if it would be necessary for mankind or for people to live in protected environments such as a biosphere.
Okay, he can certainly answer that, and will. We're going to break here at the bottom of the hour. Comes Ed Dames. Once more, SciTech Major Ed Dames. Ed?
Yeah, I'm here, right?
Okay. Is there anything that we should get on, that you wanted to get on, that we haven't managed to fit into the program?
I think I should just spend just a moment just to reiterate some of the details on the Starman and how important this area is. It's
you
not
bet.
Just this area. It's the idea that you can attract these things, these windows, and conduct an exchange. It's very much like a 3D virtual display area. Remember the movie Forbidden Planet, where
sure.
the creature from the id was all of a sudden illuminated and you could see its features?
Oh, yes.
Like that, Art. It's just like that. Only these are diaphanous light forms that are projections of something from a parsecs away. Actually, I'm not sure how far away, but we'll find out when they tell us. But it will be a true exchange instead of just us watching some amorphous light flit around the sky.
Well, that'll be something, all right. First-time caller line, you're on the air with Major Ed Dames. Hi.
Yes, sir. Calling from Indianapolis, WIBC land. My name is Bud.
Hi, Bud.
And I really enjoy my speakeasy VCR. I'm blind, and I was wondering if blind people could do remote viewing.
We get that question, I think, every program we do.
Is that right?
Yeah, but it's a good question. And what about that?
They can if someone else holds their hand during stage one, literally holds their hand, because we have to produce an ideogram, which is an autonomic response on a paper. And these ideograms are standard reactions, just like a brain's brainwave, to outside information, to gross patterns of information. There's a standard way that the body moves in response to these. And this pattern needs to be decoded. But before it's decoded, it needs to be produced as a certain...